Market volatility in recent weeks has surpassed anything else in history in terms of both the extremity and the duration. Despite that, the so-called plumbing of U.S. financial markets has held up remarkably well, even with most market participants working from home. On this episode, FINRA's Executive Vice President of Market Regulation, Tom Gira, joins us to walk us through the evolution of our market structure that has contributed to this resilience and how FINRA and others are handling the increased volumes. Welcome to FINRA Unscripted from Hoboken, New Jersey. I'm your host, Caitlin Kiernan. We continue to record remotely due to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, but thanks to Zoom, we're welcoming back to the show from Potomac, Maryland, FINRA's Executive Vice President of Market Regulation, Tom Gira. Tom, thanks for joining us. So Tom, during this period of extraordinary volatility, the plumbing of the markets has held up pretty well. How unprecedented is the current environment?
Well, it's pretty unprecedented. There's something called circuit breakers, which have existed in the marketplace since after the market break of 1987, technically implemented in 1988. And so they've been in effect for 32 years. And prior to this March, the circuit breakers had been activated once in October of 1997. Why this is pretty extraordinary is that between March 9th and March 18th, that's 8 business days, we actually hit the circuit breakers 4 times, just to give you a sense of the perspective there. Likewise, the CBOE's VIX index, which is also sometimes commonly referred to as the fear index, hit a record high of 83 March 16th. It has receded since then and come back down. But again, those two things, I think in and of themselves, sort of give you a sense for how volatile it's been. And the circuit breakers that I mentioned before, I think what's also notable about what we've been experiencing recently is how many times we've come very close to activating them. So even though we only activated them 4 times, there were many days where they were coming right up to that limit.
That is pretty remarkable to have 4 events in such a short amount of time when there's only been 5 events in history. What happened in 1997 to trigger that circuit breaker?
Well, that's a good question. I'll try to give a short answer because it could be a long answer. At the time, there were some issues with how the Asian markets were doing and how the currency markets were doing. But it wasn't like, obviously, the environment that we have today. And so there was actually a fair amount of debate after the circuit breakers were activated on that day. They actually were activated twice. With the circuit breakers, there's different levels. And so at the time, if the Dow Jones moved, I think it was 250 points, it shut down for 30 minutes. If it moved 400 points, it shut down for the rest of the day. And that's actually the only day that there have been 2 levels hit back in 1997. But it's important to keep in mind what the level of the market was. When the circuit breakers were first implemented back in 1988, to hit that first level, the market had to move 12%. And I think the Dow was like 2,100 points back in 1988. In 1997, the Dow had experienced a very good run in the market. The Dow was roughly about 8,000. And the circuit breakers were based off of an absolute point structure, not a percentage structure. So that first level that was activated in 97, it only took a 4.7 move in the market. And the second level only took a 7% move in the market. So there was a lot of debate saying we needed to modernize the circuit breakers because, frankly, the economics of the market at that time, a lot of people thought didn't really warrant the markets shutting down, that it could have been not a normal day, but a pretty volatile day, but nothing where the market should close. And so after that, the bands were then sort of widened and became done on a percentage basis, not a point basis.
That makes sense. 250 points today would be about a 1% move. So it makes sense that you don't want to fix it to a point basis. And is it still tied to the Dow or has that changed as well?
No, that's where it gets you into the flash crash. And 9/11 is another event where people ask about circuit breakers sometimes. But what happened that day is the markets actually never opened. But the flash crash is another day where there was a precipitous drop in the afternoon. It was a 9% drop in the market, but after 97, it was set at a 10% level. So it didn't activate the circuit breaker because of how they were changed then. However, there were some changes with respect to the circuit breakers. And I'm sorry if I get too technical here, but the Dow Jones is a price-weighted index. The S&P indices and most other indices are capitalization-weighted indices. And so those are probably more accurate if you're going to be basing sort of a market movement. You'd want to be doing it off of a capitalization-weighted index. So it shifted and is no longer activated by the Dow. It's activated by the S&P 500 index. And then the exchanges and FINRA came up with a different activation structure where there would be a level one limit would be a 7% decline in the market. Level two would be 13%. And level three would be a 20% decline in the market with a provision that once you got after 325 in the day, you wouldn't shut down if you hit a level one or a level two. And they also moved the duration to 15 minutes. That was what happened after the flash crash. But I'll say recently what we experienced on some of the days, there was so much pent up negative news and how the futures were going pre-opening. It went down so quickly, it activated within the first minute of trading. Do we now sort of need to factor that in? If there's so much that it looks like you're going to open so far down, do you want to open it up for such a short period? Or do you want to make sure it opens for a minimum amount of a period before you do shut it down? So there seems to be an evolution as you go through. Every event is different, which is appropriate. A relook of how you might be able to improve or tweak the circuit breakers based on the events that have occurred. Because at the end of the day, you want to avoid shutting down the market. You want the markets to be open at the time when they really need to be open in those types of periods. So it's a balance. And I think as a policy, you want to do it in truly extreme circumstances in a way that isn't creating more disruption when they are activated.
These modifications to the market-wide circuit breaker weren't the only major changes to come out of the flash crash. That market event also led to the introduction of limit up, limit down. Can you tell us a bit about that?
The circuit breakers are based off of a broad market move of a broad index like the S&P 500. But I think what the flash crash also showed is you can also have sort of the mini crashes on a stock-by-stock basis. And so the limit up, limit down structure was put in place. And the best analogy I can think of to explain it is, I don't know if you've ever done this when you go bowling and you can put the bumpers so that the ball won't go into the gutter. That's kind of like limit up, limit down, and the stock market is the bowling ball. What it's designed to do is there's a reference price that is calculated throughout the day. It's based off of a 5-minute moving average of the price of a particular security. And then the limit up, limit down says, okay, you go 5% above and below that amount, and that's where the market can go. And so the ball can bounce off of the bumpers, but it keeps rolling. If you do get into a situation where the national best bid is at that upper limit, it goes in what's called a limit state. And if it doesn't bounce down from there, it'll go into a 5-minute pause. And similarly, if the market goes down and stays at a limited state, it'll also go into a pause. They're not shutting for an entire day, but it's a way to sort of keep it in a band. They're intended to complement each other. So if you have a single stock issue, maybe there's news that hasn't been announced, but there's news in the marketplace, it's a way to sort of deal with that. And there could be volatility in certain sectors where the whole market may not reflect it in a way that might activate the circuit breaker. They're much more, I would say, flexible, and it's not really a halt per se. It's more of a band. It could result in that, but usually it's just to sort of keep the stocks in a band in an orderly way to go up and down as that average might change.
In an average day, how often might you see limit up, limit down triggered on different stocks? And how does that compare to what we've seen more recently?
Before this volatile period, you could probably measure in single digits, teens, how many times a day that would happen. And we saw last couple of weeks that we hit a peak of 1,475 were activated in one day. And that was on March the 18th.
That's a lot. So that's like about 100 times more than the usual.
Yeah, at least.
That's pretty crazy. And I think there's one other type of volatility moderator for the market for short sales. How does that work?
It's a multi-layered thing. It's what are called the short sale circuit breakers. And this one, it's activated on a stock-by-stock basis, and it looks at down 10% relative, I think, to the previous close. It measures that. And when it is activated, short sales have to be executed in a stabilizing way. So you can't sell short at or below the bid when a stock is in that state. And it stays in that state for that day and the next day.
How has the activation of the short sale breakers shown up in recent weeks?
I think it was 6,000 stocks were subject to it throughout March at various points. Because the list constantly changes because of which ones are moving 10%. To put that in context, I think typically you'd have about 250 that were subject to it at any given time in the past.
That's crazy. So these are very, very outsized numbers for all of these market volatility moderators. And even though there's been some extreme numbers with all of these different moderators, what would you say about the overall resiliency of our market infrastructure in recent weeks?
I've been very pleased with how the markets have done. I think the SEC gets a lot of credit. There was a regulation that they put in place a couple years ago called Reg SCI, Regulation Systems Compliance and Integrity. And it requires entities like the exchanges and FINRA for our critical systems to make sure that they have capacity to withstand these volume surges or persistent volume surges, backup facilities, scale tests, all those things that you need to do to have sound technology. I think we're seeing the benefits of that. We really haven't seen significant outages. I'm actually not aware of any where it has had an impact on the market. But also, I think what I've been really pleased about is the infrastructure and the integrity of the technology is there, but also the compliance. And what I mean by that is you want markets to have good information flowing through them because you want to be able to price the assets as best you can. And you want to have information that makes for a good audit trail because we've got to monitor all this. And so there are things like trade reporting that have held up very well. We're seeing that there's 0.01% late trades coming into the systems, and that's terrific. There's another regulation called Regulation National Market System, Reg NMS, and there's a lock cross rule and a trade through rule that are part of Reg NMS. We're seeing for trade throughs, there's a 99.9% compliance rate. For lock cross, we're seeing a 98% compliance rate. OATS, which is a hyper-technical rule, requires firms to capture things down to the millisecond in terms of how an order makes its way through the system. And we're seeing the compliance rates with OATS hanging at 99.9%. So typically in prior periods of extreme volatility, which might just be a day or two, you would see a degradation and the integrity of the data. And so the fact that we've got more of a persistent time of extreme volatility, like one I don't think we've ever experienced before, to have those compliance rates stay at those levels is impressive. And I think the firms deserve a lot of credit. We have our job to do to make sure that people comply with those types of rules, but it shows that there are very sound systems in place at the firm level too. And that's terrific.
It shows that those systems are functioning even though many firms, just like FINRA, are working remotely and don't have staff on site. So that's even better.
That's right. And I think it's automation. Once you've got something up and it's programmed properly, it becomes a lot more portable.
Well, that's great because I know that these compliance rates are important for your group in Market Reg to do their jobs. And we'll get into that a little bit more later when we talk about what your team is seeing in the different patterns that you run. But before we switch over to that real quick, we've talked broadly about these volatility moderators in the market and all the volume out there. But I wanted to talk more specifically about the different markets, starting with equity. How has volume in the equity market compared to the average?
In the equity markets, we've been looking at how they were in January of this year and comparing them to how they've been in the more volatile period. And we're starting that period with February the 24th. And as a percentage growth, right now we're at about 81%. So the market is 81% greater now than it was in January. I think that back in March, that was maybe about 120%.
FINRA is also responsible for overseeing the over-the-counter market. How are the numbers looking in the OTC markets?
The over-the-counter market has actually held steady in terms of its market percentage. We're at about 37% right now, and we were at about 40% before the volatility. Looking back at prior periods of volatility, there was a tendency for the volume to migrate to the exchanges and sort of away from the ATSs. And so The fact that our volume has only gone down about 3% is notable. And I think as we look at it, it looks like there's maybe more volume shifting to wholesalers that's allowing for that decline not to occur.
And what about the bond market?
In the corporate bond market, we've seen about a 9% increase in the trade volume, but about a 25% increase in what's called the par volume, the value of that trading.
So more bigger trades in the bond market. And have there been any meaningful differences in the bond market between investment grade and high yield?
The bond markets are more disaggregated than the exchange markets. It's much more difficult to price and trade in that market. There is our TRACE system that disseminates trade reports, and obviously that helps firms in terms of how they price. And there are some increasingly more electronic platforms for trading fixed income securities. But I think that market has probably been under more of a challenge than the listed markets. And I think in the last 2 weeks, the spreads relative to Treasury and other things, the spreads have sort of started to come back into alignment, not with the way they were before, but less wide. And I think we're seeing that more so with respect to investment grade versus high yield. And also, I think you're seeing more stabilization with respect to the institutional market, a little less so for the retail market. And hopefully that trend will continue.
So given all of this increase in volume across these markets and volatility generally, does anything change about FINRA's regulatory approach in this environment?
Definitely. You know, I would say prioritization and escalation is something that we are more actively doing. We want to focus on those issues that are creating more risk to the market, more risk to investors. So thankfully, in terms of risk to the market, if we saw a lot of late trade reports or no trade reports coming in from a firm, that would be something that we would be picking up the phone and asking what's going on. We really haven't had to do that as much this time. But in terms of the marketplace, we want to make sure, as happens in the past, people will prey on volatile situations, you know, natural disasters, pandemics. So Greg Rupert, who just started recently and head up what was formerly called OFDMI, and now it's called the National Cause and Financial Crimes Detection Program, started a COVID-19 task force because there are companies out there who are going to be claiming they've got a testing solution or vaccines and things like that. So that's in the works. And we also are looking to make sure that we're connecting all the dots that we need to connect. So we are having constant dialogue with staff from the SEC and the CFTC to compare notes in terms of what we're seeing with what we're doing. So long way of saying, it's a risk-based approach in terms of how we are spending our time right now. We want to spend it in a way that best maximizes the integrity of the market. And that can be through focusing on manipulation, focusing on issues that relate to potential customer harm. So that's sort of how we approach it.
That makes sense. And your team, are they all working remotely as well?
Yep. We all went remote starting on March 16th. And it's another thing I've been very pleased with. Kudos to our CIO, Steve Randich. I think as an organization, FINRA was very well positioned to go remote. And it wasn't necessarily a new thing. The duration is new, but people had been working remotely before this. So it's gone fairly well.
That's great. And speaking of Steve Randich and our technology, if we weren't using the cloud, where would your team be right now?
You know, I can't even think of it. The volumes we've been contending with and the need to run all the patterns and everything, we would be really, really, really challenged to do what we need to do if we weren't in the cloud.
How is the alert volume looking for your team relative to a more normal market period?
It depends on the surveillance pattern, but in a nutshell, we have a variety of WICAR cross-market surveillance patterns, and those are looking at for things like layering and spoofing, AutoX manipulation, other things where people might be trying to spread their activity out across multiple exchanges or broker-dealers. Some patterns have experienced an increase of only 6% in the alerts. Others have experienced an increase, I think the maximum is 167% increase in the alerts. So it sort of varies. And again, whenever there's sort of volatility, it can create a lot of false positives. And that's something we need to wade through and hopefully can do quickly identify the false positives so we can spend time on the true alerts.
I believe one of your surveillance patterns also looks at best execution. What are you seeing there in terms of alerts?
I think right now we're seeing about a 10% increase in those alerts with respect to pricing in the fixed income market. That sounds like a very high number. And unfortunately, it means more work for the analysts to be able to sort of see what were good, relevant, prevailing market prices at different price points. And that's harder when you have a volatile market. So something could look like a problem and may not be. But that's what our analysts will be doing, is sifting through all those things and making the calls they need to make.
And for firms who are looking to ensure that they are meeting their best ex obligations, the part of the rule is the prevailing market conditions. How does that play in?
We actually added to our frequently asked questions related to COVID, and there's also a webpage that people can go to find this information on FINRA's website. But we just reiterated that best execution has always been a multivariate analysis, and it's based off of the stock, the marketplace, the timing, volatility, the liquidity, a variety of things. And one of the factors that firms should be taking into consideration are the current market conditions. And so we just sort of reiterated that rule isn't going away, it's still on the books, but that during volatile periods like this, there's a recognition that it might be more difficult to execute trades. And so that could mean weighing some factors more or less than others. You might be weighing speed over price if you really want to get out of a position.
And I imagine the challenge is different for fixed income, which is generally less liquid than it is for equities, which generally has more liquidity in the market.
The fixed income market, it has its challenges, and we want to make sure that notwithstanding that the markups, given all the conditions, even though they might be a little higher, that they're still reasonable and that people are still getting best execution of their orders while recognizing best execution, a factor is current market conditions.
So the CAT, the Consolidated Audit Trail, the SEC has made a couple announcements about that in recent weeks. Can you give a quick update on what they were and what they mean for firms?
I think probably for firms, one of the most significant ones, well, they were both pretty significant, maybe in the short term, one that dealt with the timing of the rollout. So the industry member reporting is slated to have started in April, and the SEC moved that implementation date to May the 20th. So the first date that was up was April 16th, was for equities, and then we had options that would be in May. So there could possibly be some further action by the commission on this. The way it stands right now is the equity implementation date and the option date are within 2 days of each other, unless we have more of a buffer there for the firm. So it is something that there's active discussion on as to whether there might need to be some additional adjustments to the dates. But from a technological standpoint, FINRA CAT has built the systems and they are ready to go. So it really, it's intended to make sure, recognizing that because of COVID-19, firms might have had more difficulty testing and moving to remote and doing all those things simultaneously, that the firms just needed a little bit more time given the conditions. The commission also allowed us to handle PII, the personal identifiable information. And this is the information about specific customer accounts at the broker dealers. And so what it basically allows is that CAT would not be taking in PII with this new structure, that they would still have to give us an account number that would be unique to each account so that we can look at an account across all the broker dealers. But it takes out no need for a social security number or no need for a specific account number that is at a firm that's used for the customer. It's called a hashing mechanism where you take a number and transform it. Actually involves double hashing. And so I think it allows us to still have the benefits of the granularity of the data, knowing that one particular participant can be identified wherever they are in the marketplace. But I think it goes a long way towards reducing CAT as a cyber target if there were ever to be a breach. You'll hear some people refer to it now as it's like phone book data in terms of the extent to which we have information about specific customer accounts.
Will it still allow for enhanced surveillance in terms of where there might be accounts operating in concert?
Yeah, it doesn't compromise that uniqueness of the accounts. We just get to it in a different way with what the commission approved.
So before we wrap up, what has most surprised you since this all began in earnest in mid-March?
I would have to say the resiliency of the markets. I think just how the compliance rates have stayed at a high level, capacity, often something that was very hard to model in the past because the markets kept growing and growing and growing. And just the volumes that we're seeing that the exchanges and FINRA and the clearing houses are able to contend with, it's been surprising. Again, I think a lot of credit goes to the SEC for that with respect to adopting Reg SCI. I also think just how people have shifted to a remote work environment. Again, FINRA, all the firms, that was a pretty incredible shift pretty quickly. I think it sort of seemed to accelerate more in that week before everybody sort of went remote. And there were certainly some adjustments that went on, but it feels like things have sort of stabilized in terms of we still get information from firms when we need it. Sometimes they might need a little bit more time, but firms have been very responsive given all the things we've gone through.
And the last question is, at the top, we talked about how the way our markets are regulated, it's an evolutionary process. The circuit breakers evolved over time. If we were to see an evolution after this current situation, what would you hope to see changed for our future?
I would say probably two things. One would be including futures and equity and options more so with respect to CAT. We're spending a lot of time and effort to build two legs of the stool, and futures is the third leg. And I think it would benefit the futures markets, it would benefit the CFTC, everybody. But I think every time you turn on the TV, they're showing the futures prices, and they really have been, and have been in the past as well, sort of the price discovery market in a lot of ways. And to do that holistic surveillance and knowing that the traders are certainly looking at all the arbitrage and how intertwined all these instruments are, I think for us to have that same intertwinement with how we do the surveillance by having that data together in an integrated way is necessary. And maybe this will be a catalyst to have people rethink that. You know, we talked about the fixed income market, and I do think that we at FINRA have been very big advocates for transparency, and I think we need to continue to push in that way. There's pre-trade transparency in the fixed income market. I think there's real growth in electronic platforms, which is sort of pockets of maybe more pre-trade transparency. But I think we probably need to think about, do we need to do more in that area as well?
Well, Tom, that's all my questions for this episode, but thanks so much for joining us for our second remote episode. Listeners, if you don't already, make sure you subscribe to FINRA Unscripted on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you have any ideas for future episodes, you can email us at finraunscripted@finra.org. Till next time. Since the recording of this episode, the SEC has further extended the CAT reporting timeline for broker-dealers to June 22nd for equities and July 20th for options. For all the latest information, please visit finra.org/COVID-19.
Please note, FINRA podcasts are the sole property of FINRA, and the information provided is for informational and educational purposes only. The content of the podcast does not constitute any FINRA rule or amendment or interpretation to such rules. Compliance with any recommended conduct presented does not mean that a firm or person has complied with the full extent of their obligations under FINRA rules, the rules of any other SRO, or securities laws. This podcast is provided as is. FINRA and its affiliates are not responsible for any human or mechanical errors or omissions. Parties may not reproduce these podcasts in any form without the express written consent of FINRA.